Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
So, hello, Ilona Thompson with Palate Exposure, coming to you from sunny and incredibly adorable Carmel. I'm here with Scott Caraccioli, who is a proprietor and GM of Caraccioli Cellars, very well-regarded wine house. I'm feeling very lucky to be here this morning because you guys are going to get a lot of insight, more than you possibly even bargained for, and I can't wait to get started. We have a little sparkling in our glasses. It's a very good way to start, always. And we'll dive into a bit of history. So tell me about your family. You're an agricultural family that grew vegetables. When does dynasty start?
Yeah, so thanks for having me. I'm a fourth generation agricultural row crop farmer in terms of my father and uncle and brothers and cousins are totally focused on the agricultural side of business, where we grow lettuce, asparagus, celery, broccoli, cauliflower, all of the row crops basically in the Salinas Valley floor. And in 2006, my family saw an opportunity to develop 124 acres of land in the northern Santa Lucia Highlands, which mm-hmm. is basically the finger benches above the Salinas Valley, mm-hmm. and pretty bad ag land. It goes from 250 feet of elevation to about 500 and change. So if you had to irrigate it all the time, you'd have a bunch of runoff. It's just not ideal. Mm-hmm. But what it is ideal for is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. So my father and uncle basically got to the point of developing that property mm-hmm. to Pinot and Chardonnay. And we planted in 2008, but right around the same time that we were developing the property, digging 87 test pits, seeing all the different blocks that we were going to develop within the property, my father met Michelle Salg, who had recently retired from Roeder Estate. Oh, wow. He was the founding winemaker there, retired in 04, met my father in 06, and really this became my family's passion project as much as Michelle's. Ours from the standpoint of we didn't want to make any concessions. We wanted to make the most quality-driven sparkling wines that we could out of the Santa Lucia Highlands. And Michelle's standpoint being, okay, I know how to do that. Mm-hmm. We're going to pull everything at night. It's going to be 60% Chardonnay, 40% Pinot Noir. It's going to be aged 4 years on the lees, press it 120 gallons on the ton. All of the idiosyncratic pillars that make our wine what our wine is was really developed and perfected by Michelle. Mm-hmm. Really taking Champagne process and tradition and how he adapted that to Roeder Estate over the last 30 years or so, and then bringing that from Anderson Valley to the Santa Lucia Highlands in Monterey County and being able to perfect it for 2,500 cases of sparkling wine every year that would be vintage and could showcase some of the idiosyncratic vintage differences mm-hmm. where I don't want to just make a house style, something that's going to be exactly the same every year, mm-hmm. but we do want to make something that from a quality standpoint and a style and experience standpoint yeah. is very similar, but we'll show vintage difference from year to year.
It sounds pretty unprecedented in this area. Were you the first producer that really went after this type of quality sparkling wine?
I would say we were the first that really owned the process mm-hmm. from the beginning to the end, mm-hmm. really wanting to make grower-producer bubbles, mm-hmm. especially that would be vintage and would not be utilizing other people's equipment or skill sets, mm-hmm. but really keeping everything in-house. Mm-hmm. So, and at that volume, I mean, we're not big, but it's not 100 cases of sparkling. Yeah. It's 2,500 to 3,000 kind of depending on the vintage. So really wanting to make sure that while we were kind of pioneering a style of wine, that we were setting ourselves up for success in the way that we were doing it. Mm-hmm. And really that's Michelle's expertise. And in terms of knowing exactly what those things that we needed to do were. He was always a firm believer that sparkling wine kind of quality comes from three main things. A, the quality of your grapes. Mm-hmm. You kind of can't cut that out no matter what. And once you pull them off the vine, you've basically got your capacity of how good that vintage can be. Mm-hmm. Almost everything else you do from that point detracts value. Mm-hmm. So your ability to get it off the vine at night into small FYBs that are all 25 to 27 pounds, so there's no pre-mox whatsoever, mm-hmm. and to ensure that you get it to the press, the berries are still cold, and you press it off in the right way, and then you go through all of your processes. So starting with the fruit is number one,
yeah.
and number two is having that process, and number three is not deviating from it. I think the easiest thing to do when you're making sparkling wine is let other people do it, cut corners, say that this isn't that important, this vintage, we're not going to do this and that, when in actuality, it's the sum of the parts. And all the little steps that you make allow you to get to a very quality-driven product where it's going to be clean, it's going to be expressive to the way that you want it to be expressive, and it's not going to just be a product of process, but also a product of place and time. And kind of taking those inputs and making sure that I'm also a firm believer in this is something Michelle used to position as well, is you kind of can only dance to the song that's on. So you got to take the vintage and then take your process and then give yourself the best opportunity for success. And if you do have a vintage where the grapes aren't there, which we've had once since 2006, just don't make it.
You know, sparkling is such a different style of wine, not just in terms of taste, but also in terms of the process. It's a product of patience and a lot of attention to detail, but also transparency. You actually spoke very powerfully about how it shows every single flaw, so you really can't afford any mistakes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. To me, when you are producing sparkling wine, really the only tool that you have to make it better is your dosage addition. Other than that, your bubbles are naked. They're showing you every flaw that they have. They're standing on a pedestal and they're letting you know everywhere that you went wrong. Mm. So when you're going to set up your processes, your beliefs, and the pillars of how you're going to produce sparkling wine, taking the fact into consideration that when you're done, everybody's going to be able to point at everything that you did wrong. Mm-hmm. Makes it even more essential that you don't deviate from the things that allow you to make the best sparkling wine. And whatever you decide for your site, for your weather, we have a lot of acid in the Santa Lucia Highlands.
Yeah.
The wind comes out of Monterey Bay, it rips down the Salinas Valley, we're at the north end of the Salinas Valley. So when we're harvesting, we have blocks that have total acidity of 10 to 13, our pH comes in at 2.95. Mm-hmm. So it's racy. And mm-hmm. it's 6 years from harvest about to release. Mm-hmm. So to your point, it totally is a product of patience. Mm-hmm. And when you're going to take that long, you kind of got to do it right. You yeah. can't just make the shortcuts. You can't say it's not going to be that important. You got to go through and dot all your I's and cross all of your T's, because at the end of the day, everybody's going to know if you didn't do it. They're not going to know what happened most of the time. They're just going to know they don't like it. And to me, wine and like food and everything else, if you drink it or eat it and it doesn't give you visceral pleasure, you don't like it. And I'm not trying to force a square peg into a round hole. We don't make 100,000 cases of sparkling wine. We make enough that I can do it the right way. And being able to do it the right way, the way that Michelle was able to teach me and my family and prior to his passing, and really give us all of the tools necessary to continue on and now take our estate fruit and really increase the capacity of what we can do here and be able to go to the next level. I think it's important not to get short-sighted.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the most common misconceptions about sparkling wines? You're in public all the time presenting your product. What do you hear most often? that you can cite?
I guess I was, when I started doing this, I was not in the wine industry, and my family started the project, and then I came in and was hitting the sales trail and interacting with consumers. We opened up our tasting room in Carmel, and I was working this for every day for like the first 9 months it was open. So having that interaction with consumers, when we had made 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 before we'd opened the tasting room, getting that feedback to me was very interesting, because I was surprised how little most people knew about sparkling wine. I felt like I was kind of on an island when I came from the outside in terms of getting to learn everything from Michelle. And it seemed more abstract in the short term, and then in the long term, everything's very sensical. Everything's done for a reason. And I think a lot of people don't really understand the process, and I get why. It's pretty complex. It uses a lot of French words. When we talk about champagne, a lot of times most of the verbiage goes back to lees aging, dosage, disgorgement, all of these terms and vernacular that a lot of people don't know what they mean. So it's just in general less digestible, and I think part of that is because there's not a slew of sparkling winemakers in America. So we go back to champagne, where that's the epicenter, and it all comes out of explaining the process, kind of comes out of that tradition. So I think it's just less easily digestible for most people. So in the tasting room, when I'm on the road, I try to spend a lot of time just explaining to people the care that goes into the process, all the steps along the way, why it takes 6 years to get from harvest to release. And I think in that, people start to understand a little bit more about why doing something method champenois, there I go using French process in terminology, doing something like the traditional method in champagne gives you a different result than if you force feed carbonate still wine. And there's something more delicate. People come in and they know that small bubbles and mousse is great, but they don't know that that comes from lightly pressing, so you don't have as much protein in your cuvée. So when you go through secondary, the bubbles are more fine. Like those types of things, really being able to share the what and the why, I think makes it a lot more easy for people who aren't in the industry to kind of get that next level of understanding, which I think a lot of people just like sparkling wine or like champagne. So getting to fall into the why and the how it gets to here is really fun. Like that's maybe the most enjoyable piece of getting to share a wine with people, is getting to kind of talk about how we get from A to B. And in 2016 was the first time we ever made a Blanc de Blanc, for instance. My son, who was 6 months old, not even 4 months old, threw the last couple grapes in the press when we were loading it. And I was sitting there thinking about it, and I was like, God, he's going to be going into first grade before we release this. It's going to be like that position of time. And then I started thinking about all the little things that I needed to do from A to B to kind of get to that position of it being ready for release. And all of the comprehension that goes into doing those things correctly. And it kind of gives you perspective on how I share things with other people. I'm an open book, very transparent about like what we do, why we do it. And it just kind of provided some opportunity for reflection, I guess, from that standpoint.
So you just gave the listeners an incentive to come in. Those of you that travel to Carmel, now you know you can't afford to miss the tasting room, because they potentially could have a direct conversation with you. And like you said, you're very transparent, very open, and you know, you share so freely of your craft. And I think that going to the source and asking them questions, there's no such thing as a stupid question, is always the best way to go. So please take note of that. On the production side, so I had a very recent conversation with a French vigneron, Jérôme Legrasse, and he was talking about the importance of traditional grape varieties when it comes to making wine. Methode Champenoise, but he also talked about how he would really love to see indigenous varieties in different countries being used more and more frequently, and not just sticking to Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and Pinot Meunier. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
So I know the next varietal that I would make sparkling wine out of that's not one of the traditional three. And it's directly out of Michelle's bank of what we would try next. I think most varietals don't lend themselves really well to sparkling wine, mm-hmm. because, and a lot of areas don't lend themselves well to sparkling wine because you don't have the phenolic ripeness mm-hmm. at 19-ish Brix mm-hmm. to be able to have non-vegetal expression mm-hmm. with structure that's necessary for Lee's aging and then ultimately a position of balance. But there are varietals that in other places would give you that chem. So then you could go and potentially go through and do traditional method and get to there. I don't think making Chenin Blanc sparkling or Zinfandel sparkling in really warm climates is like the most idyllic thing, just from a standpoint of where a lot of times you're going to get that position of balance when you harvest mm-hmm. from where what the juice is actually going to give you the ability to do. I think most often we associate Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier as the go-to varietals because more often than not, they're going to give you that chemistry that will allow you to make good sparkling wine. Mm. But I do think in one-off locations and a lot of other places, there are varietals that lend themselves well. Obviously, you don't want a lot of tannin, so that throws some varietals out. You want acid. Mm-hmm. You want young expression to be phenolically ripe. Like, there's certain pillars that you can want to make this out of that, but you can get all the way through and it's going to end up flabby.
So very site-specific, very climate-driven. Personal question, recent New Zealand experience, love Sauvignon Blanc. Mm-hmm. New Zealand actually has a group that calls themselves, Methode Marlborough.
Okay.
It's a rather small group, but they make wines in the traditional method and have very restrictive self-imposed rules. And they, in fact, only use Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and a little bit of Meunier. But I've also tasted some fantastic sparkling Sauvignon Blancs there. And I kept thinking, what would it be like to make this really extraordinary sparkling Sauvignon Blanc? In your mind, in that context, is that possible? In Marlborough, specifically.
It's kind of out of my area of expertise. Sauvignon Blanc's a little bit different because it's so aromatically lifted still, young. Yeah. I think you can do it. It'd probably be very site-specific. Okay. I do think, you can do it out of Riesling. I mean? From, a similar standpoint of another off, sect, or even I have some friends locally who make really enjoyable Riesling sparkling wines where at that lower Brix level, you're not getting the petrol expression.
Okay.
Or any of that. It becomes more more of a clean white grape,
okay.
which really lends itself to sparkling. I mean, that's part of why Chardonnay works so well.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. There's a lot of chemical elements to it that for the layman, even such as myself, you're just not aware of the true reasons why things are what they are in terms of production. You just know what you like. So in your case, you use Chardonnay, Pinot Noir?
Chardonnay and Pinot Noir only.
Only, okay. So which sparkling wines do you make?
We make a Brut Cuvée, which is our flagship wine, 60% Chardonnay, 40% Pinot. Mm-hmm. We make a Brut Rosé, which is probably our most popular wine. Mm-hmm. And that ends up being the same cépage for 99% of the Cuvée and 60 Chardonnay, 40 Pinot. The other 1% being still red wine, Pinot Noir, that's vinified as red wine at 23, 24 Brix, and then gets added back right before we start secondary fermentation. So we'll bottle the Brut, we will add the red wine to the vat, and then we will bottle the Rosé. And what that does is it takes away the guess. Mm-hmm. Michelle is very much a control freak, and therefore I am too. So throwing cuvée on pumice, and basically doing Sagnier, you don't know where you're going. You have an idea where you're going, but once you pull it off the juice, off the skins, you get what you got. Where I can do trials of different barrels at different addition levels, lay them down for 2 or 3 weeks, taste them blind, come up with an answer, do it again next week. If I get the same answer, I'll bottle at that level with that clone. So it's more of a precise process for us and just not really giving anything to chance that we don't have to chance. And it's final good to final good. So, I mean, does it cost a little bit more? Sure, because I'm adding 1% of something I could sell elsewhere as opposed to putting something on the skins that costs me nothing else extra. But to me, wanting to make a rosé that was not just an amuse-bouche wine or a flourless chocolate cake wine, but something that you could eat with pasta in the middle of a course, had the flexibility, gave your red fruit expression, but wasn't flabby and just sweet, was really important. So those are our main two sparkling wines that we produce. I also do a Natur every year. Sometimes I do two. It only ends up being like 46 packs because we have to hand disgorge it and it's a pain. but that's always really fun. It takes a long time to get ready. Right now, current vintage of Natur is 09. Current vintage of Brut and Brut Rosé is 13. So just waiting for it to get to that optimal position of consumption. And Natur's kind of peak later and for less amount of time. So you got to kind of watch them all the way along the way. And then we also, in 16, I made a Blanc de Blanc. 17, I made a Blanc de Blanc and a Blanc de Noir. And in 18, I made a Blanc de Noir. So those will be out in like 20, 22, 3, and 4. But those are, that's what's in the hopper in terms of on-lease aging. There's not 30 cuvées. I'm not going to make 30 cuvées. At this point, everything from 2015 till now is estate. It will always be estate.
Okay, 2015 on.
Yeah, I won't deviate from that. Most of our, the fruit from 06 to 14 came from our neighbors. Talbot, Sleepy Hollow, a couple of vineyard Hans Zone. Yeah.
Being facetious, of course. Those are really famous sites.
Yeah.
So would it help the consumer to think of sparkling wine as wine first?
Yes, 100% to me.
Good.
Like, to me, sparkling wine is just wine. It's wine with bubbles, and it's wine of a different expression, but it's wine. And I guess the thing that I always think about is, so now at this point I pull all 124, I pull all of our production from the 124 cases at a school, which is the name of our vineyard. And we do this at the sparkling wine at 19 bricks. At about 22 bricks, I make still rosé. At 23 to 23 and a half bricks, I make Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. So getting different expressions and different processes through bricks maturation through the point shows the similarity in the place as well as the vintage, and make, to me, makes our sparkling wine even more so wine and a pillar of what we do, because it gives you that backbone to understand what Northern SLH is about. And a lot of it is structure. And we lean into it. I don't shy away from it. We have acid. Our wines are great with food. I'll bottle age it if I need to. I'm not going to rush it out. But to me, not wanting to hide that, I don't put anything through malolactic in the sparkling or the Chardonnay. And instead, just kind of will lean on bottle aging if I need a little bit more time to get it to be ready. Is a firm belief that I think a lot of times sparkling wine gets categorized as a celebration wine or something you have when you go out. And in actuality, to me, it's one of the most food-friendly, versatile wines that there are. I mean, you can eat it with a variety of different things, from fish to pasta. You can eat it with steak, which is something that you and I were talking about earlier. And the tie of Maillard reaction that happens when you add dosage back to the cuvee at the point of disgorgement and the Maillard that happens when you sear a steak, there's a play there and it works. And if you're going to have a really heavy, rich piece of steak with something else that's rich, you want acid to cut it.
Yep.
And absolutely. Bubbles can do that, regardless if in your mind you think you need to drink Cab or Barolo or Syrah. Like, there's other plays that will get you to where you want to go in that same expression.
Carnivores are rejoicing now, I'm sure. because there you go. You can open your favorite sparkling as long as it has good acidity and structure, and you're totally fine with red meat.
Yep.
You really highlighted a sense of place when you were speaking of how you make your wines. Is that a top value in terms of hierarchy to show through your end product?
Yeah. To me, it really is something that growing up here, living here the majority of my life, my family being involved in agriculture and putting so much into the land and the place and loving Monterey County where we're from, I'm not going to produce wine that then the process shies away from where we are. And to me, American sparkling wine should kind of taste like sunshine and process. Like there's something to American wine, Santa Lucia Highlands wine. We have great sun exposure. You get really great development. Our wine shouldn't taste like cold champagne. It should use the same process, but you should be able to taste some of that California sun. And I don't want to hide that. I don't want to mask it. I don't want to mask the acidity that you get because of the wind. I want to know what we're dealing with from a raw material perspective when we bring the grapes in. And then Michelle has perfected the process over time, and we continue to do so every year. But how do we highlight that which we feel is most quintessential to place and time?
I love that word, sunshine. It just makes you happy just repeating it. So there you go. From a professional source, you can feel very good when you look at your glass of California sparkling wine and feel like it's sunshine. From the grape growing standpoint, I know your family has been in business generationally, and but specifically growing fruit for sparkling wine program, are there meaningful differences in growing Chardonnay and Pinot Noir?
Yeah, and I will say that they've probably lessened over time, but that's just because I pulled back irrigation on our vineyard to the point that it's been dry farmed for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. So when you apply water to 19 bricks harvesting as opposed to 23 isn't really important because I'm not applying water anymore.
Yeah.
At all. So it doesn't really matter much in terms of like making an artificial spike in bricks or dumping acid or anything like that. It mm-hmm. doesn't really occur. More than anything on our vineyard, the difference in growing, a lot of times people will hang more fruit for sparkling wine. I don't do that either. I go between 3 and 4 tons an acre, kind of depending on block and clone mm-hmm. and how that block historically produces, but mm-hmm. a lot of times in sparkling wine production, you can have a much bigger crop, and the belief is it won't affect the quality as much because mm-hmm. you're pressing it so light anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm also very tied to the fact that I think proper phenolic development happens because of crop load at 19 bricks, where it still holds into the structure that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. So not wanting to be short-sighted in that, I kind of try to toe the line a little bit, I guess.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.